This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The new Pixar-Disney animated movie, Up, is now out on DVD, just in time for the holidays. Our guest is the film's director and co-writer, Pete Docter. He also directed Monsters, Inc. Up is about an unexpected relationship between an old man and a boy. Carl is a 78-year-old whose beloved wife has died. Carl and his wife dreamed of being adventurers, but were really homebodies. He made his living selling balloons. Now his neighborhood is getting rebuilt around him, and developers want him to move to assisted living so they can tear down his house and put up a high-rise. Carl refuses, and his way out of the problem is to tie thousands of balloons to his house so he can fly the house to South America, where he once dreamed of making an expedition with his wife. But as he's getting ready, a chubby 8-year-old boy named Russell knocks on the door. Russell's wearing his Wilderness Explorer uniform that has a sash covered with badges.
Photo print. SD card.
Good afternoon. My name is Russell, and I am a Wilderness Explorer in Tribe 54, Sweat Lodge 12. Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
No.
I could help you cross the street.
No.
I could help you cross your yard.
No.
I could help you cross your porch.
No.
Well, I gotta help you cross something.
No, I'm doing fine.
After Carl slams the door, he cuts loose the balloons and starts piloting his house to South America, not realizing that Russell is still on the porch. So Russell and Carl become companions on this fantastic adventure. Terry Gross spoke with director and co-writer Pete Docter about Up last spring.
Pete Docter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I love the image that a lot of our listeners might have seen in one of the ads of this old man walking through this exotic jungle landscape, you know, Paradise Falls, mm-hmm. with his house attached to a string that he's carrying as if the house were a balloon, but the house is being held aloft by all these balloons. And it's a beautiful image because it's him trying to take his past with him. It's the home he lived in with his wife for so many years, and she's passed away. So he's carrying the past on his back, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point it becomes too heavy. It becomes a burden, and he has to figure out if he should let go or not. And I thought, like, I don't know how that image came to you, or if you originally meant it to be like a metaphor, but it's such a beautiful image about carrying the past and how it can sometimes become too heavy, too much.
Yeah, it kind of evolved. I mean, as all things do, you know, we started with something about balloons themselves are very poetic and evocative to me, and more than just helium and vinyl or whatever they're made out of, you know. They become this almost metaphor for life in a way. I remember as a kid having a balloon and accidentally letting the string go and watching it just float off and into the sky until it disappeared. And there's something about that even that feels very much like what life is, you know, that you it's fleeting and it's temporal. And so something about balloons were really appealing. And also the idea of escape and floating away. And so as we developed the whole story, it became a lot about trying to preserve the past. You know, this guy, the whole world has changed. Everything around him is different now. The only thing he has this feeling of connection with his wife is his house. So he can't just leave that behind. He has to take it with him.
It reminded me a little of Fitzcarraldo. Did you ever see Fitzcarraldo?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a Werner Herzog film,
sure.
In which this explorer who wants to build an opera house in the South American jungle, in order to get to where he's going, he has to carry his steamship over a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And the burden of that reminded me at some point of the house being dragged,
absolutely,
dragged through
yeah.
the air across.
Absolutely.
Did you see the movie? Did you think about that?
We watched it along the way, yeah, and it was very similar in the sort of preposterous nature of this. You know,
yes, right, and surreal. And,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sounds like a laugh riot, doesn't it?
Well, it's really funny, and I'll tell you, you had me from the start because very early in the film, the young version of the older man, because it starts earlier in time, like in the 30s and
right.
the Prohibition era. So he's watching like one of those old newsreel kind of things about this adventurer who goes to Paradise Falls, a forgotten land. And you see like the scientists and the explorers with a protractor.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's so funny, a protractor.
Well, it was high tech back then.
High tech,
I guess.
Yeah. So you had me right at the start. Well, did you watch a lot of those newsreels and shorts before making your movie?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was a lot of fun to not only try to pick up on the film grain and stuff. You know, we noticed that when they would say be in the jungle, they'd have to develop the film themselves, so it would have less contrast, maybe a little washed out. And then versus the film they shot in New York, that would have really striking blacks and whites. And so we tried to mimic all that in the film, as well as even the way we recorded the music. You know, working with Michael Giacchino, we identified, I want heroic, I want drama, suspense, I want this. And so we just did all those, like, library music, and then we did really bad music edits between them. So it's going along, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, you know, so it'll have these awkward transitions, just like, you know, the real real newsreels.
Just in talking about the old man, one more thing about him, like, the way he sits down in a chair, it's like he slowly lowers himself, and when he gets within plopping distance, he just like lets go and plops into it. And I've seen so many older people have to sit that way. Like, you really got it.
That's great. You noticed that. The other thing we did is he pulls his pants up, like he grabs right above the knee and kind of hikes up his pants. I have no idea why older people do that, but you notice that a lot, you know, just to, I guess, to so that it doesn't get hooked on your heel or something. Anyway, we did look at a lot of folks, our grandparents, and we went to an old folks' home. We kind of came in under the auspices of being a band because I play the bass and a couple of guys who played the ukulele. And so we were playing for these guys and secretly kind of taking little notes for ourselves.
Oh, that's really funny. What do you play? What kind of music?
It was sort of like a Tin Pan Alley type stuff.
Oh, that would be perfect, because it's the kind of music a lot of people, like, in assisted living facilities would have grown up with.
Yeah, they said, oh, you were the greatest band we've had in here for a long time. So it was great. It was a fun fun time.
You created a great creature for the movie, this exotic 13-foot bird named Kevin.
Right.
Well, that's because Russell names it Kevin.
Yeah, exactly.
But I want you to describe the bird that you created.
Well, Kevin is a 13-foot-tall flightless bird, very iridescent plumage, sort of based on a crane that I saw at a zoo. The attraction for me was that these birds, when you see them at the zoo, they almost have no expression. You can't see what they're thinking. They give you no kind of advance warning of are they happy or sad, or at least to me. I'm sure bird experts can tell. But they're really unpredictable and quirky and funny. And I just, the animator in me was like, I want to animate that. So that's kind of where Kevin came from, was just the joy of seeing these quirky behaviors.
So, but you gave Kevin emotion, the kind of emotion you couldn't read in the real bird
right.
that you based him on. So what kind of methods did you find for giving your bird emotion?
Well, the cool thing was we did the same thing that I described, where there is no facial expressions. And the Muppets do this wonderfully, where, you know, you have like Fozzie, who has no facial other than he can open and close his mouth. The rest of it's just movement. And so the bird has a great deal of expression and a range of attitudes, but it's all through movement. It's almost like Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton, which, of course, all animators study, and those are our roots. So, you know, just through the movement, the posing, the speed at which they move, we were able to get all this attitude.
There's a bunch of dogs. There's a pack of really, like, mean dogs, and then there's a really pleasant, companionable dog named Doug.
Right.
First of all, I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, they go to this, like, exotic place. And usually in adventure films, especially in the old ones, before people were very kind of politically aware of what they were doing in movies like this, you know, adventurers would go to an exotic land in Africa. And then the natives would want to cook them in a big pot. And it was just, like, the most kind of insulting image of indigenous people that you could ask for. And you made it possible to not deal with that at all by having the villains, with the exception of one person, be dogs.
Right.
So you didn't – and there's a good guy dog, too. So you didn't have to worry about, you know, offending anybody. Or
yeah, and of course that is one of the staples of adventure film, so I won't pretend we didn't at least discuss that. You know, we had some ideas about that. But, yeah, it just seemed, again – keeping on the sort of isolation thing. And there is something for those of us who have dogs as pets. I mean, I'm sure most people have the same experience as I do, is we make up dialogue for the dog. So the dog is sitting next to the dinner table and we make up things that she's talking about, which most of the time is, are you going to eat that? Because I could help you with that. If you need help, I am happy to. So that's kind of where the talking dogs came from. And Bob Peterson, who did most of the dialogue and actually did the voice of Doug, just has this great mind for thinking like a dog.
And explain how it is that Doug can speak, the dog.
Yeah, the invention we came up with was this collar, which allows the dog's thoughts to be translated. So the dog in behavior is acting just like a normal dog, panting or doing whatever, but you're hearing the dialogue from the dog's brain. So that allowed us to focus on things that a real dog would focus on, which is, you know, food and sniffing at squirrel, you know, things like that. So,
and the collar has adjustments so you could change the language.
Absolutely. Very important.
Let's hear a clip of Doug, the dog, and listen to his voice. And the two main characters are in this, too. And Bob Peterson, one of the writers, is mm-hmm. doing the voice of Doug.
We have your dog.
Whoa.
Wonder who he belongs to.
Sit, boy. Hey, look, he's trained. Shake. Uh-huh. Speak.
Hi there.
Did that dog just say hi there?
Oh, yes.
Brad!
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you. My master made me this collar. He is a good and smart master, and he made me this collar so that I may talk. Squirrel! My master is good and smart.
It's not possible.
Oh, it is, because my master is smart.
Cool. What do these do, boy?
Hey, would you go de acuerdo contigo? I use that collar. Watashiwa Hanashima. You talk with me. I would be happy if you stop.
So that's a clip from the new Pixar Disney animated movie Up, and my guest, Pete Docter, co-wrote and directed the film. Pete, what are some of your favorite talking animated animals?
Huh. Well, I mean, of course, the Bugs Bunny, and there's a dog named Charlie Dog that I always think of. It was a Chuck Jones character. Let's see. Other favorite characters. Well, I mean, I tend to drift over to the Warner Brothers characters as my favorite just characters because they're so rich and funny. As movies, I tend to drift over to the Disney films, you know, as stories and things. Dumbo is one of my favorites. It's just such a simplicity, a wonderful simplicity to it. And as a kid, you know, I saw certain things about it, all the fun and, you know, pink elephants on parade and flying with the crows and things. And now looking back on it, it's got this added dimension to it as a parent that, you know, when you have baby mind, the scene with the trunks and they can't even see each other. They can just kind of hold trunks. I've yet to watch that without crying, you know. And Cinderella is great, too. It's got a great sense of pacing. I hadn't seen it for a while and watched it again a couple of years ago. And it's just got this great rhythm where you allow for moments. We tried to do this in this film as well. In a way, this film was trying to harken back to some of those films where you set up a situation, and instead of having to go, what happens next? What happens next? Move it along, move it along. You can allow the characters to just behave and react. And to me, some of the greatest animation, Miyazaki does this, Hayao Miyazaki in his films, these just little observations. And that's all they are. They don't further the plot, but they are beautiful little glimpses into real life, somehow captured and distilled and made even more real through animation. And that's what we're trying to do in this film as well.
Now, I read that for the voice of Russell, the boy in the movie, that you cast the brother of a kid who actually came to audition.
Yeah.
The kid that you cast didn't come to audition. He was the brother of the kid who came to audition. How did that happen?
Well, yeah, and hopefully that hasn't caused a rift between them.
That's what I keep wondering. Like, what's it like to be the actual acting brother and not get the part?
I know. Well, yeah. His brother, Jordan's brother, Hunter, still does quite a bit of acting on his own. So I think he
survived.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, we were looking for somebody. And, you know, this is always a treacherous area to walk into as you're approaching something like a kid. Because it's so easy to be cloying and sappy and or just like bad acting, you know. And we wanted this to be authentic and real sounding. And when we heard this kid, he came in and, like you say, he wasn't even planning to audition. His brother stepped up and they said, thank you, great. Well, how about you? Jordan, why don't you come over here? And he just, I think he talked about judo or something, you know. And his voice just made me laugh. He had this really wonderful, sweet, innocent voice. And it's a little bit like you hear the stories of the voice of Thumper from Bambi. You know, they were reading kids, and the director said, oh, get him out of here. He can't act. And the animator said, no, no, keep him, you know, because there's something really charming and quirky and kind of undefinably odd. And that's exactly what we got with Jordan. He just has this really great appeal to his stuff. And then, of course, we did have to work a little bit to get some of the acting. He covers a big range of emotions. And having never done it before, you know, we basically did a lot of tricks where, like, you know, we tried to get him to laugh and it was just not really working. So I picked him up by the ankle, held him upside down, and tickled him as he said the line. So as he's being tickled by the bird, that's what that is. So, yeah, it's a tricky gig, especially here. You know, you're in a room that has, and we record the dialogue first, of course, so there's no animation to react to. You're just in a gray room with a bunch of words on a page, and 9 times out of 10, no other actors even. We try to read opposite. Bob Peterson and myself would usually read opposite, but it largely has to kind of come to life in their own heads, the actors.
The movie is dedicated in part to one of the Disney animators from the early days. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Joe Grant was a guy, and this was really the great pleasure of having worked on Toy Story and having that be as successful as it was. Suddenly I got to meet all these old heroes of mine that had made all the Disney films, you know, Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson. And Joe Grant was basically second only to Walt in development, the story development team back in the 40s, 30s and 40s. He was head of story on Dumbo and designed the Wicked Queen in Snow White. So really, you know, amazing artist. And he was still working in his 90s. That's when I got to know him. And he was just one of these guys who was always looking for new ways of expressing himself, new techniques, new pencils or pens. And one thing he talked about a lot in when I would pitch him things was, what are you giving the audience to take home? And at first I was like, well, what does that mean, taking the audience to take home? What he was talking about was, what are you putting up on the screen that's emotionally relatable, that they will identify with and think about not only when the movie's done, but the next day or the next week or the next year? And, you know, that's what we always try to do in our films, and it's definitely there in those great Disney films.
Earlier in the film, you have to establish, since the movie is in part about an older person's relationship to his past, you have to establish what his past was mm-hmm. before getting into the heart of the story.
Right.
And you, in just like a few minutes, establish this like beautiful relationship with his wife. You know, they meet as children. They both share this love of adventure. And it's a really kind of sweet but also sad relationship. And when she dies, you're just so sad. And it's so much to squeeze into, what, 3 or 4 minutes. Can you describe a little what went into reducing a whole backstory and a marriage and a life into this little sequence?
Yeah, that was probably the sequence I'm most proud of. That scene is just, and we started much like you would writing, say, a term paper, where you go way long. You just put in all this. We had a bunch of scenes that were little with dialogue and just little short little bursts of life. And then we assembled all that together, and we realized, oh, this is way too long. And so Bob Peterson had written this great first draft of it. Ronnie Del Carmen, who's our head of story, started drawing it. And he has this beautiful way of just kind of kissing the paper with his pencil. And they're wonderfully expressive and very sort of poetic, lyrical drawings. And we got to that point, and we kept cutting and cutting, and we took out dialogue. We took out sound effects even. And it was sort of inspired a little bit by my parents growing up took a lot of Super 8 films of us as kids. And looking at them now, they're just these almost more emotional experiences to watch because the sound isn't there. You know, all you have is the flicker of the projector. And I think you as an audience member are sort of drawn into that and participate a little bit more.
Tell me more about the impact of those Super 8 movies that your parents made of the family when you were young.
Yeah, I mean, they're just films of us standing in a hole my dad dug to plant a tree, or my mom walking around pregnant with my sister. And, you know, these are like I have probably fleeting glimpses in my own life, memories of that. But watching them on screen, they're kind of I don't know. And there might be something about the fact that they're projected as well, that they're just kind of shadows of a past that and as you watch it, it's like I say, I think because there's no sound, you're missing something. It becomes slightly more abstract and yet almost more real. In the same way, we have tapes, audio tapes of my sisters and I talking as well. And that's almost more emotional than videotape. When you get them both together somehow, it's almost you can sit back and watch it like TV. It's kind of everything's fed to you, whereas by taking one of those elements away, you have to be more actively participating in the experience.
Pete Docter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Pete Docter, director and co-writer of the Disney Pixar animated film Up. It's now out on DVD. Terry's interview with Docter was recorded last May. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Military families dread the knock on the door that brings the news a loved one has been killed in action. The new film, The Messenger, is about the soldiers who deliver that news. Today we'll hear from a Marine who handled that duty. For 3 years, Steve Beck delivered tragic news and helped survivors get through the terrible period that followed. He's now a lieutenant colonel and our guest, along with journalist Jim Sheeler. Sheeler's book, Final Salute, is about Beck, the families he notified, and the loved ones they lost. The book's an expansion of the Pulitzer Prize-winning article Sheeler wrote for the Rocky Mountain News, where he spent 5 years covering the impact of the Iraq War at home. He now teaches journalism at the University of Colorado. Lieutenant Colonel Beck is founder of the Remembering the Brave Foundation. He was deployed this week to Afghanistan. Terry spoke with them in 2008 when Final Salute was first published. It's now out in paperback. Her first question was for Lieutenant Colonel Beck.
In the 3 years that it was your job to knock on doors and deliver the news that someone's loved one had died in the war, did you learn what were the best ways of breaking the news, like phrases that you could use that would maybe soften things a little bit or convey the kind of emotion that you, or lack of emotion that you felt you needed to convey?
It's a very tough question. I don't know that I learned how to do that. I don't believe I learned how to take away emotion of the most horrible news that can be delivered to someone. It is wrought with emotion. What you must do is convey to them that their loved one has fallen, their loved one has died, and that you're there, that you have empathy for their pain, and you're there to care for them and to help guide them through what will prove to be some of the most difficult days of their lives. And so you go with an empathetic heart. But at the same time, you go standing as strong as you can so that you can be their oak and they can lean on you in the times that will come, which will be some of the most difficult times for them.
Being there to lean on is actually part of the job. How long are you expected to remain close to a family and be there to support them?
I don't think we have established a set time for that. That really comes down to the relationship that is formed between a family and a casualty officer or a fellow Marine. They know you're a Marine. They know you're trying to take care of them. They know you're there for them. If a relationship's formed between casualty officers and family members, they could last for years. Or if they don't form in those times of adversity that they're going through, they may dissolve when your duty is completed and you've taken care of the family as much as you can.
Do the families often know what the news is going to be as soon as they see you?
I think so. It's my belief that when they see us at the door, that they know that something bad has happened. and they all know that their loved one's serving in combat, and we just don't go make house visits. So if we're standing there in front of their door, I think they always know that something very bad has happened.
Yeah, they're instructed in their – this is Jim. They're instructed before their service member leaves that if their loved one is injured, then they'll get a phone call. And the only way that they will know that if they've died is that if they get a personal visit. And I mean, I've talked to mothers and wives who – I mean, they'll circle the street two or three times just kind of eyeing in front of their house looking for that government van, looking for things that aren't right, because they know that if it's there, then the worst has happened. And they try to put it off as much as they can, put it out of their minds, but it's always there.
You're there in part to help the person to whom you're delivering the news. You're there to deliver it and to help them. But when they see you and they figure out why you're there, you're the symbol of the worst thing that could happen. And I guess I'm wondering what it's like to knock on a door knowing that you are going to initially be that symbol.
Well, the way I've come to terms with that, for me personally, I know that I'm delivering the worst news that they could possibly hear. And it's incredibly painful for me. But what drives me forward is knowing the pain that they're going to go through cannot even possibly be compared with the minimal pain and discomfort I'm feeling. And so I can put mine aside quite easily, knowing that the pain I'm about to cause with this news and my responsibility to them, America, to take care of that family is more important than any discomfort that I have.
Jim, you write about how Marines always go out in pairs when they're delivering the bad news. Why are there two Marines going to each home?
Well, there's usually the casualty assistance calls officer plus a chaplain. I mean, nobody knows how somebody's going to react to that news. And I think they've decided that having two people there is the best way to do it. The Marines actually do it different than the Army. In the Army, they have someone who will knock on the door, and that's pretty much his job, is to deliver the news, and the family never sees him again or her again. With the Marines, that person that delivers the news is the primary casualty assistance calls officer, and they're there for the rest of the whole process.
Well, grief has many faces, and when someone's getting this shock, they respond differently, and so anger should be expected and planned for. I felt all the different emotions that they were feeling at the time, and I know the reality of it is that I'm not the person they really want to lash out at, but I'm certainly don't mind being that person, because they need to do that. They need to do that with someone, and it's better that it is me than, or the casualty assistance calls officer, than someone else in their family or otherwise, or themselves for that matter. So taking that on is not something that we're concerned about, but we go out together, and we have a chaplain with us as well. So I think we're with another Marine and a chaplain, I don't think we can go wrong.
Jim, one of the stories that you tell in your book is the story of Catherine Caffey, who lost her husband in Iraq while she was pregnant. And it was Colonel Beck who had to deliver the news with her and who stuck with her during this horrible part of her life. Would you describe the story as you understand it of how she responded when Colonel Beck came to the door?
Sure. Catherine was actually taking a nap when they knocked at the door. And her stepfather answered, and as soon as he saw the Marines there, he knew. And then he stepped back, and Catherine's mother saw them, and she screamed. And then he went in to wake up Catherine, who had heard the screaming of her mother, and she asked what had happened, and he just said, "It's not good. You need to come outside. And as soon as she saw Major Beck and the chaplain there, she knew as well, and she started screaming. And she screamed and screamed. She ran into the other room, cradling her her pregnant, you know, belly, and she just glared at the Marines from the way she and her parents and Major Beck describe it. And she just went and took a bath, and she sat there for a long time before she came back out. And a lot of the families have that sort of reaction of sometimes they refuse to let the Marines in, period. They say, if I don't let them in, it's not going to happen. They'll try and delay the message. But eventually, it always gets to them.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with Lieutenant Colonel Steve Beck and journalist Jim Sheeler, recorded in 2008. For 3 years, Beck notified families their loved one had been killed in action and helped the families through the tough period that followed. Sheeler's book, Final Salute, is about Beck, the families he notified, and the loved ones they lost. One of the people Sheeler writes about is Catherine Cathy, who learned from Lieutenant Colonel Beck that her husband Jim was killed in Iraq. She was pregnant when she got the news.
Her husband's casket arrived from Iraq on a commercial airline, an American Airlines flight that landed in the Reno Tahoe International Airport. Colonel Beck, were the passengers on the flight aware that there was a fallen Marine in the cargo?
They were. What we often try to do, it doesn't always happen, but we try to make sure that through the help and the assistance of the airlines, we'll communicate. At least it was something that I like to do every opportunity that I had with a particular airline, was to let them know, to radio ahead to the pilot and ask them to ask the passengers to remain seated while we took care of our fallen Marine. And so my understanding is they were able to do that on this particular flight. They did also know that point in the war, many people realize that when there's a service member in a dress uniform on board, that they may be transporting someone home. So in this particular instance, the pilot made an announcement and asked everyone to remain seated, just as we would like, and show their respects as we bring our brother home.
And Jim, you write in your book that commercial flights aren't used anymore in this way. Why did that change?
A father in California complained after learning that his son would come home on a commercial airline. And since then, Congress has passed a measure that allows the families to choose whether they want their sons to come home, or sons and daughters to come home, on commercial flights or on private chartered aircraft, which in some ways is better for the family. And they've also instituted a rule that those caskets are to be met by a full honor guard and given the proper treatment.
There's an incredibly moving photo of Catherine, who was very pregnant at the time of her husband's death, draping herself over his coffin. Jim, I know you didn't take the photographs for the book, but did you and the photographer ever feel like it was intrusive of you to be there observing or photographing this period of grief?
Well, the photo was taken by Todd Heisler, who now works for the New York Times. When we first met Catherine, it was in her home a few days after her husband's death. And she, like all the other family members, just simply wanted to talk about her husband. She wanted to tell Jim's story. And I've found this continually. It doesn't matter anybody's politics. The family wants their son or daughter's picture on the front page of the paper next day. They want their stories told. And so we sat with Catherine for hours just talking and talking. And the one thing that really struck me was she told the story of how when they found out she was pregnant, that she took up knitting, because Jim was in officer candidate school at that time. And she would knit and knit. And when she found out the baby was coming, she started knitting baby blankets and baby booties. And the night before Jim left for Iraq, he slept with that baby blanket. And he did it because he knew he wouldn't be home in time to see the baby born. But when the baby was born, he wanted the baby to know how he smelled. And for me, that really said all that needed to be said about Jim Cathy as a person. And we also made a connection with Catherine. After spending hours with her during one of the worst times of her life, when we left that night, she said, thank you. You know, this may sound strange, but you guys made my night. Because we were able to take Jim's story and share it with so many people. And so when we got to Reno, it was basically the most difficult question that I had to ask in the whole reporting process was to ask Catherine if we could come along for everything, for the entire process. By this time, we had been following Major Beck for about 9 months. And but we hadn't seen everything from the inside, you know, through the family's eyes directly. And so I asked her if we could come along for everything. At that point, I probably knew more about what was going to happen than she did. But I told her that if there's ever a moment that you feel like we're getting too close, we're too intrusive, all you have to do is just wave your hand, look at us funny, and we're gone. And I think by giving her that power, she realized that she didn't have to use it. It kind of created this trust that remained throughout the entire process. The night that she was sleeping with Jim's casket there, she decided to sleep with Jim's casket the very last night he was there. And at one point, just before she fell asleep, she looked up at one of the Marines who was looking over Jim's casket, and she said, "Are my reporters still here?" And he said, "Yeah, you want me to get rid of them?" And she said, no, I just wanted to know that they were still here." So we were comfortable that she was comfortable with us being there and that she wanted people to see what she was seeing.
Jim, you've attended about a dozen Marine funerals as part of your reporting and your research for the book. As an outsider, as a person who's a reporter, not a Marine, what did you find most interesting or most confusing to you about the actual Marine funeral rituals?
I think the most amazing things are the things that you don't see, the things that are happening behind the scenes. Yes, there's the very formal and very important ceremony where the Marines are folding that flag for the last time that so many people have seen. But at the same time, a lot of times the Marines will go to the houses, the homes of the relatives or the family members, and station themselves at the house because they know it's been in the paper that this family's not going to be at the house. So they want to have that covered, that nobody's going to rob that house, that this family's going to be taken care of. One mother just told me, the Marines are everywhere right now. You don't even know where they are. And so I've made it my job to try and find out. And it was pretty amazing to find out that the escort who brought that Marine home is there and will not leave the casket unattended. And the Marines themselves will not leave that casket anywhere where the public can get anywhere near it. There's going to be two Marines standing at the head and the foot of their brother. And just that dedication is pretty amazing. Some of the Marines that I talk to will, while they're standing post there, they'll talk to the body, even if they never knew him. They'll talk to him when they come up into the airplane and say, hello, you know, you're home. They take this very personally. And when you talk to them about the impact, it's pretty incredible. You know, they're trained to kill, really. I mean, they're trained to fight, and they know how to fight as good as anybody in any branch of the service. And yet, when you talk to them about these emotions when they pick up that casket, you know, one of them told me that you don't know, you don't understand until you pick up that casket and you feel the weight. That's when you understand.
Colonel Beck, where were you at the funerals? for the loved ones of the people who you were working with after delivering the news?
I'm the person that delivers the flag to that family. And so I am running the ceremony at the funeral. So I'm in charge of that ceremony. And so that funeral, that flag is folded by the Marines, the pallbearers there, and who carried him or her. And they fold that flag, as Jim said, for the last time. And the rifle detail puts three of the brass rounds from the rifle salute into the final fold of that flag, and they present that flag to me to present to the family.
Colonel, are you still in touch with Catherine?
Sure.
How long ago did her husband die?
Gosh. 4 years.
So that says something about the commitment that you make to a family after delivering the news.
These families mean a great deal to me, and they all have a very special place in my heart, and I hope I have one in theirs, and they're part of my family, so that's how I view them.
You know, I'm wondering, like, when you train to be a Marine, you're training to survive war and to be able to kill your enemy. When you're dealing with families on the home front, delivering the news that their loved one has died, and then being there to support the family through this horrible period in their lives, it's such a different set of emotions and skills and parts of yourself that you must have to draw on. Were you prepared for that? I mean, do you know what I'm saying? It's like being a Marine in war is so completely different than having to be with somebody while they're grieving and be there for them.
I completely understand. One of the things that Jim said and you've just repeated was that, you know, Marines are trained for war, they're trained to kill. That's certainly true. We're very good at that. The counter argument is we're extremely good at saving lives and taking care of people. The saying, no better friend, no worse enemy, certainly holds true for all Marines. So we're as adept at protecting lives and saving lives as we are at taking them. So, and as defenders of this country and democracy and freedom, I think that that's exactly what you want.
Jim, you're a young journalist at kind of the beginning of your career, and you've spent, you know, 5 years writing about fallen soldiers and fallen Marines and their families, and you've written a lot of other obituaries as well. One of the stories you tell is about a Marine who'd been a gravedigger at Fort Logan Cemetery, a military cemetery, and he had been promoted to a supervisory position. Now, he had been sent to Iraq, and when he got back, suffered a terrible depression. It sounded like he was nearly suicidal. And you write about how the place that he seemed to feel most comfortable was working in the cemetery. Would you talk a little bit about what he told you about that?
Sure. His name is Andrew Alonzo, and he's a reservist who saw one of his really good friends die in Iraq and came back and had a really hard time. He was actually a caretaker at the cemetery when he was called up to go to Iraq. So he had been burying mostly World War II veterans, Vietnam veterans, and then he came back after Iraq and was basically in charge of setting the headstones for the newest active duty, especially the Marines who were coming back. And he had an incredibly hard time with it in the beginning, but then he realized that being that last person to take care of those guys was actually a very cathartic thing for him, that that he could be, he could make sure that they were cared for. And as we were standing there, as one of the Marines was being buried, he kind of stood off in the, on the side. And after the family left, I asked him what he would have said to her. And he said he felt awkward going up and talking to her, but if he would have could have talked to her, he would have told her that it's okay. We'll take care of him now.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Lieutenant Colonel Steve Beck and journalist Jim Sheeler recorded in 2008. Sheeler's book, Final Salute, was a finalist for a 2008 National Book Award and is now out in paperback. Jim Sheeler teaches journalism at the University of Colorado in Boulder. In his spare time, Lieutenant Colonel Beck oversees the nonprofit Remembering the Brave Foundation, which holds ceremonies to formally present posthumous medals to the families of service members killed in action. He was deployed to Afghanistan this week.